So we've just come down the hallway from chatting to Ian and Kevin, and now in Adam Smith's office. Adam, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. My name is Adam Smith. I'm a lead developer on the WPF team for, among other things, the performance effort. I'm also the lead developer for the app model team and a couple of other things. But we're here today to talk about performance.
We are indeed.
That's
the
hat I'm wearing today.
Great. And how long have you been in WPF team, Adam?
It's been, I think, 7 years now.
Okay.
I joined before it was called Camelot, which became Avalon, which became WPF.
Wow.
It's been a while.
I guess most people don't even know about the Camelot days. We talk about Avalon now and again. So you're kind of part of the original kind of team that kind of started thinking about this.
Yeah, there was an effort that came out of the Trident, the Internet Explorer team, as we call the rendering engine Trident internally. And I was kind of somewhat on the side to that. We were starting with the graphics layer, kind of building ourselves up from a rendering engine, and we joined, and a product was born.
great. So I guess we were chatting with Ian and Kevin about just kind of a broad brush kind of overview of what's new in this almost V3 release for the WPF team. A service pack that's got some features in, that we've kind of got some bug fixes as well. And we kind of just glossed over very, very quickly the perf stuff. But it'd be great if you could just sort of, you know, give us the kind of high-level summary of what we're doing from a perf point of view in WPF.
Absolutely. It's a pretty exciting release because most of the work we did, at least from my perspective, most of the work we did was performance-related in one way or the other. Whether it's a new feature that enables a scenario which either didn't work before but now does to enable higher performance, or whether it's improving existing experiences. Let me start with the stuff that was strict performance, and that is cold start performance. When comparing our performance in cold start versus some of the other technologies out there, such as GDI, MFC, we tend to come up a little short in the cold start performance. Mm-hmm. That's because we're loading an extra framework, we're loading additional code that isn't already as warm as it would be with GDI applications, because every application hits that code path. So we took this to heart. We spent a lot of time knuckling down in the Arrowhead time frame. A lot of effort was put in by the CLR, the runtime itself. In fact, most of our gains came from them. I shouldn't take credit for their work there. But what we're seeing is across the board, 10-15% on the smaller apps, up to 35-40% for the new for the larger apps. Think Blend or other things of that size. And for the most part, this just happens without recompilation. You simply install the new framework, and bam, you get the improvements. So this is really exciting.
Right.
One of the other things that we spent a lot of time working on in that vein was the deployment side of things. This was less under my purview than the setup team, but it's still something we're very proud of. We've got the Arrowhead client SKU, which I'm sure you've spoken about. But that greatly reduces the deployment time, both from download and actually setup and install. Some of the other things that came out of the CLR effort were improved NGen and just-in-time compilation, so that also improves installation and startup times. And working set improvements, which will, it does actually improve your startup time, but it also improves your memory footprint, which allows your apps to play nicer with others, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's some really nice things, and most of these things, as I say, just happen. They just work.
Right.
One of the other things that we've added that's really exciting for us is it's a small thing, but it's useful, is we added a splash screen. I know, it's tiny, it's basic, but it's just our way of saying, sometimes we're not going to start up fast enough, or your app is large enough that you'd like a little something. It's been available in WinForms technologies built in with Visual Studio integration, and so we kind of came up to par with those.
Right.
So it's a small thing, but it's useful, and these are all sorts of things that will help pretty much any WPF app.
Mm-hmm.
But then we've also done a lot of work on the various feature teams to improve specific scenarios. One of the areas that we're still focusing on to continue improving our own platform and help application authors improve their platforms is our ability to scale in terms of larger data sets inside of our list controls, in terms of more complexity, those mm-hmm. sorts of things. And one of the ways we helped that scenario out in the Orcus timeframe was to add virtualization to a number of our panels. We have a virtualizing stack panel. It's used in our list boxes, list view, that sort of thing. And while that's good, it had some scenarios that it didn't actually scale. It scaled better, but not well enough. And so we've gone a step further on that this time. We've added container recycling is what we call the technology. But basically, when an item pops off the top of your list or the bottom of your list as you scroll, We will, to the extent possible, reuse the framework elements and the data binding and the templates and the controls and whatnot that were used to make up, say, that row in your list view, and we'll reuse it for the next item, data item off the bottom. And this is something you can opt into. It has slight behavioral changes, nothing drastic, but for compatibility purposes, you do have to opt into it.
Right.
But when you do that, we've seen 40% or better improvements in scrolling scenarios, and most customers will just be able to turn it on and let it go, and it just works. So that's kind of nice. To that end, we've also added column virtualization for grid scenarios. So it's the same sort of thing, but you know, horizontally.
Yeah.
So you can start to use those massive Excel scenarios a little bit better. Without worrying as much about that. Obviously, you still need to code for performance. We're trying to make it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Those are part of efforts to both improve the scenarios themselves, but also to lay the groundwork for the data grid control, which is planned for an out-of-band release later this year. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of other smaller things that we've done in that vein that will help people who are using data and lists and things like that.
Yeah.
Another thing we've done, one other thing I'd mentioned, the data grid scenario, is we've added non-live scrolling. It's, again, a pretty straightforward feature, but it really does help in that when you play with the scroll bar, you just move the thumb up and down. We won't snap the UI until after you've let go. It's, again, a fairly straightforward feature, but it really, really helps because suddenly you're only rendering the thumb and you're not doing the additional work.
Right.
And most users don't even notice. It was pointed out to me that Outlook behaves this way. I had never noticed, and I'd used Outlook a few years, you know, and so things like that are in the platform. Move on to graphics. A lot of great stuff coming out of graphics, both from scenario standpoint, but also from performance standpoint. We have a new class called D3D Image, in which we allow you to host your DirectX 9 surface. You render it, you control it, but we'll compose it into our tree. And while maybe not a performance feature per se, what it does is it's kind of an escape valve, an integration point with whatever you may want to do using your own technology, your own techniques. You can use your own video renderer, you can use your own 3D engine, for example. We're very proud of our 3D feature set in WPF, but it's not designed for Twitch games. It's not designed for image or for audio visualizations, for example. It's designed for UI. Its richness is in its ability to interact with data binding, interact with hit testing, interact with our eventing services and things like that. It's not meant to compete with Direct3D in terms of raw horsepower to the metal access to 3D. And so by providing D3D Image, we allow you to decide which technology is appropriate for your scenario. If you need the absolute best functionality in the 3D pipeline, great, use that. If you want interactivity, use 3D in WPF. Mm-hmm. If you want both, we have techniques, and we're going to see what we can do about blogging this and putting it out there in the world. But having a simple 3D scene in WPF overlay your complicated scene in D3D, so you get the hip testing and integration on our side, but the rasterization technology from Direct3D. So that's a kind of nice feature there. And then, of course, bitmap effects. If you've ever seen any posts that I've made to forums or to our, to our internal discussion aliases, from a performance standpoint, the first thing we ask is, "And are you using any bitmap effects?" It's been a bit of a thorn in our side. They have their uses as currently released, and they can be used safely. But it's very easy to get into a situation where they have an adverse performance effect that's not proportional to the benefit, and so it's one of the first things we take a look at, because designers love them, but they were tricky to use safely. Mm-hmm. And so we're very proud to be able to say, finally, a bitmap effect that you can actually, you know, use and not worry as much about. Of course, it's not free, and so we'll still be asking the question just to make sure that people aren't overusing them.
Right.
But basically what we've done is we've made it so that you can write HLSL, DirectX Pixel Shader language, such as you would use in a D3D scene, and use it directly on the WPF elements. So you can take your normal button, which remains interactive, remains responsive to events and triggers and styles and animations and all that stuff, completely live, and it just happens to be blurry or magnified. And if you've seen the mixed videos, or if you have a graphics talk later, any of those sorts of scenarios, they'll be happy to demo this. It's great eye candy. But the point is that it's now about as expensive, depending on your shader, of course, as an opacity mask would be in an existing platform. And so, we have opacity masks, we have Visual Brush. Mm-hmm. These features are in the platform, and it's now on par with those performance-wise. So you can absolutely use them in your system. And the really exciting thing is not only have we provided this for drop shadow and blur and some of our built-in effects, but we've also allowed you to write your own. It's entirely third-party authorable, mm-hmm. and your shaders will be, have, you can expose all of the properties on your shader as dependency properties, so they can be set in by animations, they can be data bound, and they're still running on the metal. They're actually running on your card, and so that's really great. Mm-hmm. It's far more than simply removing the bad parts of the old stuff. It really opens things up there.
Right.
And there's a number of other things across the board. Writable bitmap is a feature that's been in the platform, but wasn't particularly usable because of its memory consumption behavior. Basically, writable bitmap is a, you might think of it as the software cousin of the D3D image. It is a way to host your software rendered output in our system. We compose it against the elements and rotate it and transform it just like we would any other image. But you can write the contents to it in software. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the version that we have in the existing released bits, every time you flip it, would allocate memory, which was a performance concern to begin with, but then it would pile up, and then the garbage collector would come in. And so now we've addressed that, so now it's a constant memory usage, and this is the technology that is being used by the Blend team to host Silverlight inside of Blend. So it's, you know, it's proven, we're using it ourselves, it's the right technology for that, and it'll help you with the escape valve, much as D3D would be for 3D. If you need 2D rendering, for example, either using technology other than us because that's your legacy code may live, or if you're trying to do, let's say, a scatter plot with millions of points, an area that we're still, we have some ways to go before we can address that with retain mode, vector graphics, fully anti-aliased, million point scatter plot. You know, obviously we'd like to head in that direction, but it's not something that we currently scale to in those areas.
Right.
But GDI certainly does, particularly because it's raster based and static, and you know, so there's a great opportunity to use that. Mm-hmm. There's a number of just little things here and there that kind of add up. We've got a complete list, and we'll be blogging these things, and we'll be putting white papers out. And mm-hmm. Scott, in his announcement a couple weeks back or months back, so I've lost track of time, touched on a few of these things. But there's little corners here and there. You know, the text realization code moved around, which nobody cares about because if we did our job right, you don't notice. Except editing is 10% faster.
Right.
It just is. You know, things like that. And so there's lots of little things like that on the platform.
So wow, you've kind of really kind of given a very comprehensive list of maybe 15 different sort of items there that all individually, you know, they're all maybe 10% here and 10% mm-hmm. there, but pretty quickly those 10% cumulatively add up to a fairly substantive improvement.
That's our hope. Oh, and I neglected to mention the XBAP scenarios. I shouldn't uh-huh. have. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Just two things to mention there. We've improved our startup progress page so that it starts up basically instantaneously instead uh-huh. of in the past. The progress page itself used to be in WPF. Mm-hmm. Now we're rasterizing it outside of that. So it kind of didn't make sense to wait for half the startup path to start before you even brought up a progress page. Mm-hmm. So now we bring that up immediately. And then we've made the download and initialization of XBAPs more parallel, more concurrent. So mm-hmm. we actually see about 10% across the board XBAP startup improvements. Just another corner that slipped my mind momentarily.
So I'd like to just kind of go and drill in a little bit to a couple of those things.
Sure.
In particular, I think, you know, some of the things that I know have caused some pain out there with, particularly the first version, we obviously improved even with the 3.5 releases out there today, but things like the cold start piece. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can just drill in a little bit into the kind of process there, you know, from double-clicking on the icon, you know, what are the various steps that occur that make startup take, you know, a period of time? What have we done to fix those or improve those, that sort of that path? And what can developers do themselves to help kind of improve that process?
Absolutely, yeah. It's it's been an enlightening year and a half for me since I was the graphics lead in V1, and so I kind of joined the cold start effort as it was beginning, and I had to ramp up myself. It's interesting to note that the difference between warm start and cold start is primarily, in fact, overwhelmingly, I should say, disk bound. It's all about disk I/O. If you look at the cold start time, 80%+ of the time is simply loading bytes off of the disk.
Mm-hmm. And I should probably just interject, I'm sure most people know this, but to just distinguish between cold start and warm start.
Cold start
is when you're going on a clean machine, you've not clicked on the application before. Warm start is where you've closed the process and you're now reopening that process.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. In there's shades of gray in between there. Lukewarm start. I don't know if, right. If say it's been a while since you've run an app, but you have done so this run.
We've done another WPF app, exactly. And then we're opening this app. Yeah.
So the warmest of warm starts is if you have a copy of your application running already and you run a second copy.
Right.
And then that runs the gamut down to you've just rebooted your machine and no managed code is run at all.
Right.
Obviously, the more you have run since boot and the more you have running right now, the shorter your cold start time is, and it's directly related to the number of code pages, primarily code, that are already hot in memory. And XP and Vista is even better at this, are very good about trying to detect what your application tends to load at start. This is called Superfetch in Vista and Prefetch in XP. And that technology definitely kicks in. So the 10th time you run your application after a reboot, it'll be substantially faster than the first time you've done so. And one of the other things is we have a font caching service that runs across all processes in WPF. But we don't start that at startup time, so it's not to impede your boot time. But so if you have any WPF apps running, not only do you have our code hot, but you also have some of the most commonly used fonts or whatever the other application's using is already rendered for you. Mm-hmm. So that sort of thing also kicks in. And generally, our warm start has been quite acceptable. I don't know that we're going to win medals, but it's not been a common complaint, and we're very competitive there. But cold start has been, as we both said, a bit of a focus area, shall we say. So when you first start, let's say your first managed, first WPF app since a reboot, we have to load a number of things. We have to load the CLR proper. We do have to start the font cache service. Mm-hmm. And we have to load all the code from Windows, Base, Presentation Core, Presentation Framework. If you're on Vista and you're running 3.0 and 3.5, our rendering engine is partially warm because of the Desktop Window Manager, but some of that is specific to WPF. And then, of course, after all of that, we get to load your application and any code that you may have. And so the first rule of cold start, and this is actually true for almost any performance, is the best way to get fast is to not let yourself get slow in the first place. And so that is the corollary here is the fastest byte to load off of disk is the one you don't load. So defer references to those DLLs you need. If you don't actually need speech processing to handle your splash screen, maybe you don't load it then. Some of these things are you can't help because you have legacy if you're porting to WPF, and some of these things are necessary because, oh, you really do need that for accessibility purposes or something like that, just right. That specific example. But that's generally good advice, and we give that to all of our customers, and we also give that to our own internal teams who are themselves learning about how to optimize our code for cold start. And in fact, a lot of the effort that the WPF team proper did for cold start was simply analyzing what do we load, what touches what, and see if we can break any of those dependencies.
Right.
Do you actually need all of the text layout engine to throw up an image on? Well, no, you don't. And so we're looking at seeing ways we can sever that, or at least delay load those things. So then once you kind of have your application pared down, so you only need the basic functionality for starting up your application, I will basically just start spooling the stuff off of disk as it's hit. And as I say, the OS is intelligent and trying to help you out, and so it'll kick in for you there. But when we've tried to improve our platform and customer applications for cold start, and I encourage any viewers who are running their own applications to do this as well, is you simply look at what's being loaded and make sure it makes sense.
Right.
Easy. Any profiler, CPU profiler, will tell you what codes hit during your startup has, and you just look through there and say, do I really need to load this? Is this really necessary?
Right.
And a lot of times the answer is, oh no, I could just defer that, or I could just delay that, or a couple of times we found that simply by marking a method as non-inlined, which the CLR tends to try to do aggressively for runtime performance optimizations, but sometimes inlining can bring in a reference to a class or a method that you didn't actually need just yet.
Right.
So a couple of key places for that, I'm not recommending people just do this indiscriminately, do it profile-based, do it based on actual data, but a couple of things like that, just snipping a couple of dependencies, and you can improve your own startup.
Yeah.
Now, the CLR for improving the cold start, the gains that our customers will see simply by installing the framework, they came in a number of ways, but they all really boil down to compacting code, making the bytes, making the CLR itself smaller, both on disk and in memory, so that the same amount of functionality is loaded more efficiently. One specific case that's really been helped is the use of generics. I don't know all the technical details, but apparently the code that either handles or compiles generics was improved to keep them having a smaller footprint. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's been done is the CLR attempted to make sure that the references to, if there's two functions or two methods that are likely to be called in harmony, or if one is loaded, the other one is always loaded, they tried to make sure that they were more tightly bound, in fact, so that you wouldn't have to jump around the disk. Most customers aren't going to care about this level of detail, but I'll pass it on as a nugget. It's actually less about the bytes loaded than it is about the seeks on the disk. Okay. A seek from one location to another is significantly more expensive than reading a couple of extra bytes. And so, in fact, with prefetch and superfetch, in fact, sometimes we've actually seen loading just as many bytes as we have in a non-superfetch, non-prefetch mm-hmm. scenario. We turn it off sometimes for comparison purposes, for performance mm-hmm. measurements. You'll often load just as many bytes. But the important thing is that prefetch has put them in a blob, a contiguous blob on the hard drive, and so mm-hmm. especially if it's defragged, it'll just run down one sequential read, and that's substantially faster.
Yeah, yeah. So. And even things like, I understand that one of the things that superfetch does is it tends to put the things that are used heavily or used at startup on the outer edge of the disk, so because of mm-hmm. the shape of the geometry, that the mm-hmm. disk is running faster at that point. So
it's constant faster. Angular velocity instead of linear, and exactly.
Yeah,
these are the same technology and the same techniques and Xbox and PlayStation games too. The game designers I know they try to put the important stuff on the outside edge. It's kind of silly, but it isn't. It really isn't because if you get increase your read speed, which increases your performance, and bam, for something as cheap as simply moving around the disk, of course.
And of course, the corollary of that is the more WPF applications there are out there, the more .NET applications are out there, the more a lot of these things will kick in. The more mm-hmm. stuff will be shifted by Superfetch because it'll be seen as regularly accessed. The more that you'll be having a warmer start because you're not going from an entirely cold environment.
Absolutely.
You've already maybe got a couple of other apps in your startup folder that's using the same technologies.
Yeah, as soon as you've installed something that kicks in, at startup or shortly thereafter, the more line of business apps, if you're in a corporate environment, if you have a time card entry, for example, if that's...
Right.
The more you have that, the more it'll be
that's
advertised.
That's the big one. It's the killer app for WPF.
And then the other thing that's interesting, too, is when you look at a WPF application's working set, you'll see that for a small app, say a Hello World application, we do not appear to compare favorably, perhaps, to other technologies. Mm-hmm. But, of course, Hello World's where we're going to look the worst, and that is you're paying the overhead for bringing in the framework without realizing the marginal benefits of... Did you know a radial gradient brush is just as easy as a solid color brush? Did you know you've got built-in integrated support for 3D? And those things cost far less incrementally than they would to add to, say, an MFC app or a WinForms app. But the other thing to note, too, is if you look at that breakdown, an awful lot of that is code that's shareable. I mean, the framework code is entirely, the vast majority of it is shareable. And so, as you were saying, the more our adoption increases and the more apps that are out there and live, the less each one costs.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting thing also. There's kind of a... Sometimes there are smart ways to measure performance and working sets, and there are less smart ways. And that's one of the interesting sort of things, I think, that you look at... some people look at task manager and say, well, this is how much working set this application is using.
Right.
And, of course, on a lightly loaded machine where there's nothing else contending for those memory resources, it's actually a wise strategy in many cases for the platform to take advantage of the working set for cache or mm-hmm. for other kinds of it doesn't make sense to slow the machine down to run a garbage collector when there's plenty of space in the garbage can
You're absolutely right. It's we get that complaint, oh my goodness, my app is taking far more memory than I expected, and then we walk down and say, okay, well, if you force a garbage collection, does it all go away? Yes, it does. Okay, so you had memory sitting in your system doing nothing for which you paid, for which you're spending money to keep refreshed. Do you think it's maybe okay if it uses it, temporarily? It's kind of hard to... you do have to make sure that you differentiate between caches, garbage collector running less often because there's no pressure, and, my app is, using too many resources, for example.
Right.
But yeah, it's not... Especially since TaskMan is... It's one statistic, but it hides complexity. It hides the difference between your app, and it hides shared... The difference between shared and private bytes and that kind of thing. And so... it is a statistic, but it is by no means the end of the story.
Yeah. So given that, what tools do you think people should be using? What things? I mean, I know the WPF team, there are other teams mm-hmm. have some things. If you've been to many of our customers as we run labs and things, what do you tend to do as you're kind of doing that kind of performance profile on an application?
If we're talking about working set specifically, one of the things we look at, okay, well, first off, is there a leak or is it just the garbage collector being, a little less aggressive because it's the right thing to do given system conditions? You can force a garbage collector in kind of a manual one-off ways, simply do that and say, oh, look, it fixed the problem. Okay, that really wasn't a problem. In other cases, you can have legitimate leaks. They're not, in a managed world, going to be leaks like in, say, an unmanaged, oops, I dropped a ref and it leaked forever.
Right.
But if you have, for example, a static variable that maintains a reference to every object that you ever created, it's not going to get reclaimed because it is alive, but it was an inadvertent leak. There are patterns, for example, where you register an event handler with an element. Well, that's a live link. That actually is a reference. And so if the element lives, the thing listening to it will live. And usually that's appropriate. Usually that's expected. But if you forget to disconnect that when you're done with the object, you can end up leaking things. And given the interconnected nature of a WPF retain mode scene, if you leak one element, you probably just leaked your entire tree.
Right.
And so to determine those things, we have a free profiler that we, Microsoft, released. It's called the CLR profiler. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact name.
Yeah.
But if you go to MSDN, it's up there. It's got a great README. It says it's for the 2.0 framework, but that's just because that's still technically the version number for the CLR itself. But it is it's a free tool, and it hasn't been maintained particularly recently, so there are some third-party profiles out there that are very good and, reasonably priced, all things considered, so, definitely consider looking out there. The profiler that comes with Visual Studio, the Team Suite Edition, or the Teams Team Edition for developers, I think, has a basic memory, it has a memory profiler. It's not as full-featured as some of the third-party ones, but if you've got that version of Visual Studio, it's got that. And so basically we look for, if you think you're leaking, we spin up an application, we take a look at what's alive, do a few things, come back to what we thought was the same state, look what's alive now, and, if it changed, let's figure out why.
Right.
Oh, you've got a couple extra bitmaps. Why? Turns out you get a static variable referencing them. Okay, that kind of thing. And usually they're fairly straightforward to track down.
Yeah. What about outside of the kind of working sets? Are they looking more broadly towards other graphical sort of issues or other things? What things would you recommend people do?
You're kind of describing what do we do in a general customer visit there. Step one is, just look at it as a human sitting at the console. What's slow, what's fast? Figure out which portion of the application need improving and... typically, it'll manifest as sluggish, slow to respond, or stuttering animations, that kind of thing. And so we say, okay, at a gross level, what's taking the time? Is it layout? Is it rendering? Or is it, typically the third category will be not layout per se, but we're spinning up too many templates, or you're recreating too much of your scene each frame, for example. The way that we like to do it is we have the WPF Performance Suite. It's a power toy-like thing that we've released, and a new version of that should be coming out sometime in the relatively near future to kind of correspond with the Arrowhead release. One of the tools in there is called the Visual Profiler, and it gives you, real rough, high-level, not particularly granular results that says, of 100% of your app's time, it's broken down into 30% rendering, 20% animation, 50% layout, though that adds up to 100, there could be other things in there not that add up to 100, but using those numbers, there are a couple other categories. That basically gives you a rough direction, and if you see 95% of your time being spent in rendering, okay, your scene is either too complex or you're changing too much per frame.
Right.
If it's 95% layout, it's like your rendering is fine, but you're doing too much work to recalc each frame, for example, perhaps. You're changing you've got some sort of automated thing changing the width of a very complicated grid, for example. Then we spin up a CPU profiler. Visual Studio team, the team versions contain a CPU profiler, but there's plenty of third-party ones out there. And you just run it and look where your time is being taken. And if you have a decent understanding of the kind of things that happen in your application, it should be relatively straightforward to see if it is, in fact, your business logic. It's not always our code, but taking the time. But assume that it's not, for example. If it's bitmap effects, if you're using legacy bitmap effects and all our time is being spent on the UI thread rasterizing bitmap effects, then bitmap effects will show up as 20% of the time. If it's if your templates are too complicated, it'll show up as the BAML record reader, that's the compiled XAML, because the templates are, in fact, little BAML snippets that are iterated upon to allocate objects. If it's layout, you'll see a ton of time being spent in measure and arrange and a couple of core elements. And, you know, once you've done those sorts of things, you generally have a decent idea of where to go and look. And most of the time, it won't be our code proper. I mean, it may be our code taking the time, but we're doing it at the behest of the client code, of course. Usually, once you've got kind of an idea of where to look, then you can either investigate your code, saying, oh, how much work am I really doing per frame to re-render? Or you can take a look at, say, our tips and tricks white papers and scan for the bit that says, what are the things that could hit you in rendering? And take a look at, am I running software or not? In the WPF Performance Suite, we have a couple of other tools there that one is called Perforator, and it's kind of a graphics-oriented tool. A couple of basic tweaks for changing the way we rasterize, for example, turns on tinting for software. And so if you see any software rendering, make sure that it's expected and understood. Usually it's not. Mm-hmm. One that we've hit, and we've seen this in the wild as well, is you have an animating piece of content, a logo, a video, or something like that, mm-hmm. as your initial content, and you fade something in, or you slide something in, and you forget to turn off the animation. So this one you can diagnose by turning on the dirty rect visualization. So uh-huh. this shows you the regions that are the regions of the screen that are dirty each frame according to our calculations and understanding of things. And so you can turn that on, and suddenly you see that, oh my goodness, there's something huge animating behind my scene when I just expected a blinking cursor to be changing. Mm-hmm. What in the world can that be? And then you use the visual profiler in the WPF Perf Suite, or a fine additional tool written by one of the guys over in Blend, Snoop, mm-hmm. to go and take a look at your visual tree and see that, oh my goodness, I forgot spinning logo control. It's still there. I'll remove it. Or you go through that and you suddenly realize, oh, my list box has 5,000 items and I expected it to only have 12 because I thought I was virtualizing. And then you realize that by looking at the property pane or by reading our tips and tricks that, oh my goodness, turning on grouping defeats virtualization. Huh. Okay. And that's why my 5,000 items are there, and that's where all my time is going. That kind of thing. There's a number of other tools in the Perf Suite. We've got a good SDK article on them, and I'd encourage customers to take a look at that. Kind of point them in that direction, because there's the Perforator for graphics, there's Visual Profiler for initial triage. We have a number of ETU events. That's the event tracing framework that's built into Windows. And well, among other things, you can get frame rates and every time we present. And there's a lot of specific things for various feature disciplines in there to track that. Interesting, if you're curious what the latency is, for example, between the action you took and when it showed up on the screen, you can write your own ETW event. Mm-hmm. It'll show up in the perf tools, and then you can, there's a visualizer for that. There's also XPerf, which is something that we released publicly earlier this year. It's a very powerful tool for ETW and analysis.
Yeah, great. I think it's a really good sort of succinct sort of overview of the kind of techniques that people can kind of go through to kind of analyze their applications. Chatting with Ian earlier on, you know, one of the comments that he's made that I think is very sort of on the point is that, you know, with perf, you're never done. I mean, there's never a point where, you know, certainly from a WPF team point of view, there's, you know, never a point where we'd say we've done everything we can do. And I guess for a lot of applications that people are maybe familiar with historically, you know, building a WinForms app or something like that, because there's so little going on in some ways, there's not so much work to be done, whereas as you build in a much richer higher level of abstraction in the platform, that mm-hmm. inherently increases the opportunity to kind of tune and perform. So I'm really glad to see you've done some work in the 3.5 Service Pack 1 release to kind of continue that work, and hope you'll carry on doing it in the future.
That is the plan.
Cool, well thank you Adam, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.